This week on the podcast, is it the end of the road for Tesla, or will they be here until Claire dies? And we're talking about the three monthly sales metrics that you absolutely need in your business. Welcome to the Profit Cash Growth Podcast. This is the podcast for six and seven figure business owners who are looking to grow a financially successful business. My co-host, Claire Hancock, is a finance director, chartered accountant, and entrepreneur. And every week, I'll be exploring guidance and frameworks designed to help you increase your profits, improve your cash flow, and grow your business. Claire, how are you this week?
I'm having a really good week. Thank you, Simon. What
good.
About you?
I'm ecstatic. Do you know why I'm ecstatic?
Why are you ecstatic?
Because last week's podcast, the big fight off live about whether to take your profits or reinvest in your business, was our fastest listened to podcast that we've released so far.
And I'm really annoyed about this because we had a little bit of a domestic when it came to deciding whether we should use that sort of structure in the podcast or not.
And I prove that people are just absolutely loving it.
I don't think that
we should fight every
swallow
week.
Makes a summer and all
That's
that.
I tell you all the time.
We might.
Lots of different instances.
We might do a few more to trial it out, but do let us know whether you enjoyed it or whether it was just a coincidence that that was our most listened to podcast.
Well, they liked it in the UK, US and Russia, weirdly enough.
Russia.
Yes. Oh, we're big in Russia.
I don't think that's where we want to be big. So
anyway, what have you been up to this week?
Well, this week we have had a new website launch, actually. It went live yesterday. We've had a little bit of a refresh of our content, got rid of some old products and back to basics, I think is what we're focusing on at the moment. So really, really, really focusing on management accounts, building the team around that to service customers that need really good quality, good value management accounts. So yeah, really big refresh on the website and all of our marketing material this week.
Amazing. It is looking awesome as well. Profitcashgrowth.com. Just work through all of the different bits there. You can see some examples of all of the monthly packs you're doing for some of the big businesses. And yeah, I love it.
Oh, thanks, Simon. You don't normally say nice things to me, so I really appreciate that.
Anyway, we've got a jam-packed episode this week. Loads of interesting things to talk about. So let's start with this week's news story. So this week in the news, I'm pulling out the big ones, Claire. I'm going to talk about Tesla. They've been all over the news this week. Have you read about it?
Yes, they
it's
have.
It's not good news, is it?
Oh, well. I mean, a lot of people saw this coming. It's not sort of rocket science. The amount,
no pun intended there,
that the amount of new manufacturers entering the EV market, there's only so many car sales every year. In fact, car sales as a whole, in the Western world in particular, is fairly static, if not slightly declining. So it didn't take rocket scientists to work out that Tesla were going to lose market share.
Is it that they've lost market share, or is it that the headline is that their sales have slumped 9% on the previous year? Have they lost market share, or have they just other sales slumped because the whole market slumped?
Well, last year they were also heavily propped up by the supply chain backlog, where people were ordering cars and they couldn't get parts for the cars, and because COVID manufacturing plants were shut down. So there was actually this sort of pent up pre-order backlog that they were getting rid of in 2021 and 2022, which propped up sales in those 2 years. So if you take that out, then actually this static sales or slight decline has been going on for a number of years now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sales slump, 9% down on the previous year. It's knocked their share price back by a third. Good old Elon Musk has got £200 billion of his own personal net worth in Tesla. So he's going to damn well want to fix this problem, isn't he? But I guess the debates that are being had out there are around, A, whether the market as a whole for EVs is the problem, or B, whether it's just the growth of further supplies in the market. So they talk a lot about the Chinese market and cheaper electric cars coming out of China that are eating into what is a smallish EV market as it is, that's perhaps not growing as fast as it should for various other reasons. So should we just unpack that a bit?
Yeah, there's definitely more car manufacturers out there now doing electric vehicles. I mean, it was only a few years ago that Volkswagen, they launched their entire EV range, and there was such a long waiting list just for those products. I think it was in 2020, and they launched this whole range of EV products, and it was the first time that they'd launched them. So absolutely, there has been a flood of manufacturers coming to the market. And another news story in the last week or so was that Volvo, who's one of the biggest car manufacturers, I think they might be the biggest car manufacturer in the world, actually, when it comes to sales.
Really?
Made the last diesel engine vehicle ever and put it into a museum. So actually, major car manufacturers are fully committed to transitioning towards fully electric vehicles being their main source of income. So I don't think for one second it's a decline in the market whatsoever. I think if you look at the statistics, the sales of EV are still going up and up compared to combustion engines, that's diesel and petrol engines.
Are they though? Because like, I mean, obviously the other part of the headline thing, so if Tesla's down 9%, Volkswagen's EV sales are down 24% in the first quarter of this year.
But again, I've just mentioned the product launch for Volkswagen. They had this massive waiting list, a massive pre-order list that then became even more pent up because of what happened with COVID and the supply chain issues. In particular, there was a very specific semiconductor computer chip issue that would have hit the electric manufacturing, the electric car manufacturing industry really incredibly hard.
True. Yeah, I have read about that. I mean, one of the big analytics firms says this, which I thought was brutal about Tesla. What is this company going to do over the next 5 years? It has no growth. I think volumes will keep shrinking as competitors steal market share. I really think they are toast.
Well, look, this is a business that's got $29 billion in the bank. So are they toast? Absolutely not. You know, they're one of the highest value companies in the world. And you also, I think people are forgetting that Tesla, Elon Musk, one of the great things about Elon Musk is he's a little bit wild, but he sees the future. He is not looking at what Tesla is doing today and how many cars they're selling today. He's thinking about what they're going to be selling in 10, 20 years time. So he has got his eye on the future, and Tesla is not a car manufacturer anymore. You know, that's not their sole source of income. So is Tesla as a company toast? Absolutely not. Will they have growth like they have seen? No, when it comes to cars. But are they a safe and secure company? I put my dollar that this company will be around the day I die.
Yeah. I mean, you reach a point, don't you, as a company where it's no longer about a specific product. It's about that company as a whole. You look at Meta and how they've moved. You look at Amazon. You look at all of the big boys. The reality is they diversify, they acquire other companies and they build their portfolio and they
continue to grow. Well, they're not quite diversifying, Simon. Remember one of our first podcasts, I think we talked about this, and they're not diversifying. They're selling their existing products to new customers and selling new product ranges to existing customers. So they're not quite diversifying in the true term. But yeah, I know what you mean. I think Elon Musk is a visionary. And he is looking so far ahead that he will keep that business alive. With those cash reserves, they face no risk whatsoever.
He's kind of got two things. We talked a lot about the element that Tesla operate in the premium car market. And actually, have they burnt through the early adopters and the people that are prepared to buy a Tesla because it's a bit of a premium, maybe a fad, a status symbol, whatever that is. But actually, it's a pretty expensive car for what it is. And you said yourself, what's better about a Tesla than any of the others? I don't really understand it. Where's their marketing? Where, you know, we don't see a huge amount of marketing from Tesla to understand truly why their cars are better. Do they continue down the premium route, or do they, as they've been discussing, bring out a, they call it more economy car? Actually, it's still not that cheap.
$25,000 is what they're suggesting the ticket price would be, which is rock bottom compared to, you know, I think if you're trying to get like a Renault Zoe or something, I think that's that's £25,000 to £30,000 just for what we would say was a basic entry level model. So,
but you can't be all things to all people. Actually, often that can really make you fail. I mean, it's like, you know, it's the reason that Apple don't bring out a cheap iPhone, is it? Is it? Do you think that's the way out for Tesla? Is the right thing to do? Or do you think it could be suicide for them going down that route?
I think we can't underestimate the impact that the cost of credit is having on the car market at the moment as well. Because, you know, electric cars are about 20% more expensive than a petrol or diesel car to finance. So there's that element going into it. And also, insurance is incredibly expensive on electric vehicles because when they get damaged, they get written, they've got a higher rate of being written off. It sounds like I'm coming across very anti-electric vehicles here. So generally, when they're in accidents, there's a much written off. And also, the sheer weight of them means that they're doing so much more damage to roads and to other vehicles when they do have an accident as well. So that all combined, there's lots of things going into this, which is making electric vehicles seem unattractive or of a concern to people before you even start talking about whether you can get it charged or not. What I would say is, as you know, we have dabbled at looking at electric cars, and our questions that we have is around battery life. What happens in 4 or 5 years' time when we want a new car and we come to get rid of it? Does it hold its value? What happens if we can't find a charging station? And I think this is where Tesla are shocking at marketing. I mean, I've been on their website today and I can get information about their cars, but I can't get information about what life with an electric car is like.
Yes. And do you know what? There's only a handful of things that really scare me about electric cars. And if they could just deal with them and get over them, but they're not attacking them. I mean, for me, we said, well, there's a number of things. Range is always an issue with people. And it's not just because, you know, great, the headline range might be good for a Tesla, but we've talked about this in terms of, I know that the battery life of my iPhone, my MacBook, my iPad, or whatever else is, you know, it's holding half of what it is after 2 or 3 years. And then after 4 or 5 years, I need to get the battery replaced. So is that range of 300 on my Tesla going to be fine the day I bring it out the showroom, but in 3 years' time, I'm going to get 150 miles out of it because of battery depletion? That's my anxiety. I'm worried about that. And unless somebody tells me otherwise, I don't see how their batteries are any different than any battery in any other product that I've got.
And I feel like Tesla have resorted to sort of these old school marketing tactics of selling features and benefits of a product and not selling a solution or a lifestyle or a service or something like that. And really, they would benefit from reading Alex Hormozi's $100 million leads book, which says that you should package an offer that's so good people can't say no. And really, Tesla had just given me a long list of features of their car and then saying, do you want it or not? And that was good enough in the early days when they were pretty much the only Western provider of electric
as
vehicles.
As a fad, you know, because it's a nice symbol to have and a fad to drive one. But sustainably, is it right?
Every single car brand is now flooding the market with electric vehicles. So from that perspective, they've got more competition than they've ever had and they just weren't prepared for it. And then I think I do strongly believe that their marketing department is letting down the sales of their business.
Yeah. I mean, I struggle also with things like having to plug it in constantly. It's just another job to do. I don't want a job.
Once a week to plug your car and charge.
Depends how much you use it. It's just...
Yeah, it does depend how much you use it. I mean, we've looked at... We used to have two cars in the household. We used to have a big, nice Mercedes SUV and a little Up GTI, which is what Simon refers to as his go-kart. Nice and quick and nippy around town. And the lease on the Mercedes came to an end, so we are now down to one car. And we've looked at getting another electric car in our house, but we haven't made that leap. And I'm not really sure why we haven't made that leap. But I think if somebody advertised to us, we'd probably get one, wouldn't we?
Possibly. I mean, the other things is that government subsidies have been watered down over time for electric cars as well. So they don't get the tax benefits are going to get worse over time. You know how it is. They get people hooked on it and then they take the drug away, so to speak, don't they?
I'm not so sure these government subsidies make that much of a difference anyway. Mm. When the ticket price on electric vehicles is coming down all the time anyway, it sort of cancels itself out, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think that's enough chit chat about... Did I say chit chat? I
meant chit chat.
That's enough chit chat about Tesla. Let's move on to this week's deep dive. So this week, Claire, we're going to talk about 3 monthly sales metrics that you should definitely have in your business. This is following your YouTube video this week, which I found fascinating. You know, I'm a fan of a metric or 2 or 20. You've seen my spreadsheets. I track everything in my business, as you well know. I love it. It's, I think, an essential thing to running your business, whether it's financial or sales related. And I know that you'll come at it from a financial perspective, but the sales related KPIs as well are absolutely epic. Oh,
we are in the middle of a monumental storm and it is thundering and lightning and the rain is coming down. So I don't know if you'll be able to hear this when you're listening, but yeah, apologies if it sounds like a bit like there's some random noises in the background, but that is the thunder.
Anyway, so the 3 metrics that you're going to go through are business development, sales, account management and customer service and delivery.
Yeah, so they're not quite metrics. They're when I'm speaking to customers and saying, you know, just looking at your profit and loss every month is not painting the full picture for you. You need to do a bit of a deeper dive analysis on specific areas. And for small businesses, I say this all the time, small businesses generally, their overheads are not out of control because the business owner is in control of the bank and the money and really understands the costs in the business. So from that perspective, when small businesses are not making the profit that they want to or that they need to be viable, 9 times out of 10, the issue lies in the sales and the gross profit. So I think it's incredibly important that every business owner's got a deep dive sales and gross profit analysis on a monthly basis. And often when I say this to people, they will come back and say to me, well, I know what my monthly turnover is. And that's not what we mean when we say our sales analysis. So I like to break it down into three areas to get more clarity on exactly what it is that we're trying to track when it comes to sales performance. And then that allows us to be more precise and select more intelligent and useful KPIs that allow us to make sure that our sales is on track.
Okay, so what would some of those KPIs look like that you would suggest?
So the three areas that I suggest breaking it down to is business development, which is about generating new leads in your business. So getting new customers in the door, selling, launching new product ranges. So that's all about business development, is new stuff. Then you've got sales or account management, and that is about taking your existing customer base and your existing product base and maximizing sales as much as possible. And then the final area is about that customer service and that delivery to your customer and how you're guaranteeing that when your customers come to you, they get a great experience. And I think those three areas for me, when I've worked with lots of businesses, these are the three areas that I think need to be tracked individually. And as long as you track these things individually, then you can guarantee as a whole that your sales performance stays on track.
Okay. So really you're taking people through that journey of the element of finding the customer or generating the new customer. Then you've got the looking after the customer, and then you've got delivering the actual service to the customer. And then all of the metrics that you would track through each of those parts of the and process of the business.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're thinking about business development, this is, you know, probably mostly looking at your sales pipeline. So how are you generating leads? Are you getting a good return on your marketing spend? All of those sorts of metrics that will feed into business development. And mostly we'd be looking at the different stages of probably your sales funnel.
Right.
For that. Because at the end of the day, you know, if you can't generate new leads, no business is going to retain 100% of its customers forever. So you've got to be able to generate new leads in your business to grow and or even to continue to do the turnover that you're doing today.
Sure. With the businesses that you work with, what, you know, when you talk about obviously no one can retain all of their customers, what sort of churn rate, you know, what sort of percentages do most businesses lose that they need to replenish? So therefore, they need to replenish more than what they're losing to actually grow.
Yeah, I mean, there is no magic number for that. It entirely depends on the industry that you're in. You know, if you're in, you know, like online e-commerce business, then you're going to have a massive churn of customers and you are going to be heavily reliant on marketing and bringing new customers in. But if you're in a more specialist industry, you know, particularly some B2B industrial services, they're going to have a high level of retention. The more specialist you become, the more likely you are to retain your customers. But it also depends on what your customer's buying from you. You know, Simon, you're in an estate agency. So people move house, what, every 5 to 8 years?
Yeah, it's a totally different, it's a pure sales model. You know, you start from zero every month with the estate agency. You're not retaining any customers. You are with the lettings business because you're retaining a landlord, and landlords would stay for a long, long period of time and are very sticky types of customers.
So exactly. Like I say, I've got a customer that I've supported for about 15 years now. So, you know, and that is an example of when you get somebody into your world and they become a customer of yours, that's about tracking the sales and account management side of things. And that's about making sure that you can, you know, increase customer lifetime value and increase average customer spend. And, you know, what are you growing your existing customers by? And I think actually, when I look at the numbers in a business, often it's cheaper to try and sell more to your existing customers than it is to acquire a brand new customer. Often that customer acquisition cost is like the most expensive bit of a customer. So from that perspective, being able to farm your existing customer base is normally a more profitable approach to business.
This is kind of an approach that the big retailers would take around what they call share of wallet. So it's, you know, the big supermarkets, you know, it used to be you go one place for your big shop per week, and if you spent £100, then that's your share of wallet. And now they're fighting for that share of that £100 because people are splitting it in different places and different avenues. And that is, you know, growing the what they call the average basket spend of that particular customer, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we look at some of the big blue chip companies, like Amazon does this really well. When you go on Amazon, if you know, I got Amazon for everything. What did I go on there the other day for? I wanted a handheld garden battery automated garden shear for trimming the lawn edges. And I typed that in, and then also came up some other connected products that I might be interested in. But more importantly was the batteries that I needed to operate that product. So it's very, very easy for me to just pop the two things side by side in my car and check out. You know, I ordered a whiteboard the other day and they suggested whiteboard pens to me. So it's that kind of thing that helps increase that customer spend and grows that customer when they're already in your echo chamber.
Yeah, there's a few other brands that I find that are really good at this. Again, just personal experience recently, Victoria Plumbing are really good at this. So you buy the sink and they won't let you check out without, you know, rejecting the fact that you need the waste for it, you need the taps for it, you need the plastic piping for it,
ceiling,
all the things to make sure you've got everything you need. And it's that share of wallet, that upsell that actually the tradesman would usually perhaps buy that and prepare that for you. But you've just bought it as the consumer to give to the tradesman, and you've spent more with Victoria Plumbing. They've taken that trade away from Screwfix or wherever you would have bought the bits to go with it. So yeah, clever.
Yeah. And I think for business owners as well, there are so many ways that you can increase your sales and so many ways that you can do different marketing tactics. And, you know, do you do email campaigns? Do you do Google pay-per-click? Do you do Meta? Do you do Instagram? Do you know what I mean? Do you do leafleting? There's so many different ways you can market your business and generate sales. But what is it that you want to do to increase your bottom line the most? And I think when you've got some clarity on these sorts of statistics, you can then start to follow a sale from start to finish and say, okay, well, my sales that come from Meta, for example, traditionally, they bring me about 10% net profit, but my sales that come from word of mouth bring me 30% net profit. So therefore, you want to heavily invest into that word of mouth sale to try and increase that, because that's how you're going to get the most bang for your buck, if you like.
And you can see how quickly your business profitability could absolutely snowball. Because if you nailed every single one of these, if you think about the journey, you've got, you're growing your existing customer, you're extending your range of products that customer can buy, you're then upselling those different products to that customer. And then on top of all of that, you work on the lifetime retention of that customer. Mm. So that customer's average spend with you's doubled, but then that customer spends with you every month for 10 years. And before you know it, you can see how that really snowballs. I'll tell you who's really, really good at lifetime retention is people at hotels where, you know, you've had an event, a birthday or an anniversary, and they've got great CRM systems that have captured that data that you were there for your birthday or you were there for your anniversary. And then they send you a card every year for it, or they send you a video, or they send you something a week or two or a month before that next anniversary, that next birthday, tempting you with an offer or tempting you to come back. And that is how you, you know, you do some clever stuff with that kind of lifetime value.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with small businesses in particular, I see so much wasted opportunity in their existing customer database in particular. I've been working this morning actually on a free business review. And one of the things I always look at is I look at the percentage of spend that's coming from, you know, like small value customers. So the definition of a small value customer will vary wildly depending on the value of your product. But for this particular business, it was sub 1K accounts. And around about 60% of their customers were spending one time less than 60K. So, you know, how much has it cost to acquire that customer in the first place, but also the operational process of setting that customer up. You've got to add them onto your system, you've got to collect their information, all of that that goes into just getting this customer to a point where you can make a sale to them. And then you only made one sale to them. And it just seems bonkers. And I kind of, when I did the analysis, I said probably most of these sub 1K accounts, you're probably losing money on by the time you factored all of that into it. So, you know, don't do them, or find a way of increasing their value so that they buy from you multiple times.
The value of data now is absolutely insane. And for most people, it starts with just making sure that you've got the right system and tool in place in your business to, first of all, just capture that level of data. So, for example, across my business, we get something between 600 and 850 leads every month. That's 850 times that somebody has reached out to us, we've captured their email, we've captured their name, and that all sits within our what we call our lead pro system. From there, we can do the various immediate things we want to do with them, book them in directly to see something or to buy something. But actually, the data then sits then. It allows us to use that data over time as it builds up and becomes tens and tens of thousands of pieces of data that we can then build email campaigns around. We can then build different physical campaigns around. And actually, we get, that data becomes massive of massive value for, to us moving forward.
Mm. And when you have all this data available to you, the biggest risk is that there's, you know, particularly in, you know, we're in 2024 now and CRM systems are 10 a penny and they can give you all sorts of metrics about lead conversion and your sales funnel and your sales channels and your customer behavior and things like that. But what they're not tying into is the profitability element of it. And really, in your monthly or quarterly board pack, depending on how big your business is, whether you do this monthly or quarterly, you really need to be tying that sales data into your financial data and your profitability data.
So the two talk
and you're making the decision that grows your sales in the most profitable way. Because, you know, it's the age old saying, isn't it, that turnover is vanity, profit is sanity.
Yeah, absolutely.
And cash flow is king. So if you're not doing, not cash flow is king, I completely effed that one up, didn't I? It was turnover is
turnover is trash.
Is vanity, profit is sanity, cash flow is reality. That if you're not bringing that sales data into your financial data, then, you know, you risk making decisions that bring you the most customers, but it's the most customers at what cost and the most customers at what profit. And that is kind of the, what I would say, the difference between the information that you get out of your bookkeeping system, like QuickBooks, Sage, ClearBooks, whatever it is that you use, and using a specialist like myself, for example, that has done this month for years now, is about painting a picture with numbers. And you've got to paint the entire picture. You cannot just look at sales and you cannot just look at your finances. You've got to be able to bring the two together.
Yeah. And I mean, a top tip with this, I mean, you say CRM systems are 10 a penny and everybody probably has one, but actually it's one thing having the system, but it's another thing. You have a saying with bookkeeping, garbage in, garbage out. And how do you analyze it if the information you put in is rubbish? And it's the same with CRM and sales data. You can only use that data in that CRM if it's been managed into that system in the right quality and format that it can be extracted.
Yeah. And
that's a problem.
One of the things that I come across the most with businesses, particularly where they've got slightly older MDs in particular, is that the systems and the technology have outgrown what people are used to naturally. So if you haven't been brought up in that sort of data environment and you're not used to working with big data and systems, then it can be quite baffling. Even to just, you know, something I take for granted is, you know, I'm, you know, a dab hand at Excel. I'm probably like in the genius category compared to most people, not blowing my trumpet too much. But
official category.
Well, I think there's pretty much nothing I can't do in Excel, to be fair. So
you are good.
Okay. I'm very advanced. Okay. And therefore, the speed that I can crunch the numbers at and the conclusions that I can come to just will be extreme compared to what the average business owner does.
What would you say to people listening to this that are in that category, that I think that how they would describe it is probably overwhelm, even the thought of what you're describing. In fact, the way you put it across, because you are so passionate about this and because you do know it so well and you do it day in, day out, actually, you probably come across extremely overwhelming. I mean, it's your personality, you know, anyway, to talk across it, but it's like, what would they say? How would they, you know, digest that and not feel intimidated by data?
Yeah, you've got to start with one or two numbers. I always say that having a really succinct reporting information that is condensed into the minimum amount of information that you need to make a smart decision with is really critical. So for most businesses, I would say identify three things that you're going to track and track those until you're comfortable, until you've got that process slick and accurate. Is also really important. Don't run the numbers once and make a decision. Run the numbers multiple weeks, multiple months in a row before you go making any decisions.
So you would build people up month by month to get to where they need to get. So you build them a plan of going from zero to hero, so to speak, without, you know, it then feel like they're drowning in day one.
It's also a constant evolution. You know, I think when it comes to tracking numbers, you probably don't need more than 10 KPIs when it comes to like your sales analysis. And I'd say probably a minimum of three, no more than 10, depending on how complex your sales process is. But start small. Just, you know, one metric will give you more information than you had yesterday.
Yeah. I always say with KPIs, just work work through your business logically. Think about where the business starts and the cash hits the bank and each of those key metrics throughout that you feel that will give you an indication of where you are in the business, and you've got your KPIs.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. It's a really good way of looking at it. And you just, the things that you, your business finds difficult are normally the things that you need to track. So if you're constantly looking at your bank, worrying where the cash is coming from, then of course you need to track cash flow, but you need to think what's driving that cash flow. And is it that you're getting good sales in, but then maybe sourcing the product or making the product or delivering the product to your customer is taking time. And then therefore you need to track that bit. You need to track the bottleneck, and you need to keep on working on the bottleneck until the bottleneck is fixed or the bottleneck's manageable, whichever one it is. And that's what your KPIs should be looking at, is they should be looking at these sticky points, these bottlenecks, these hurdles that your business keeps coming up against.
Great. And finally, you talk about customer service and delivery.
Yeah, this is a massive one, and this is so overlooked by a lot of small businesses, is particularly business owners that are really, really good at sales and marketing. And we know from running multiple small businesses ourselves that most small businesses never get over the VAT threshold or never employ anybody because they just cannot do sales and marketing. So if you're turning over sort of 500k plus, you're going to be probably fairly good at sales and marketing. However, are you tracking the statistics around your customer experience? Because you could be the best sales and marketer in the world, but if you don't have the right stock or you have a shitty customer experience, your customers don't want to buy from you again, then that's just as bad as not having sales in the first place.
Yeah. In my industry, this is a very large corporate mentality of win the business.
Yeah.
But actually, if you follow the, have they actually made any money from it? Well, they've not. So if you look at the difference between those that take that strategy of win the business at any cost, they probably sell 30% of the house stock that they list versus a good, strong local independent, which sells 65% of what they sell and turns that into cash.
Yeah, so we're talking about the estate agency model here, aren't we? Where you're competing with corporates that overprice houses consistently and tie people into long contracts, and that their sales team, and we know this is fact because we're quite good friends with a number of people that work in corporate estate agencies. So we know for a fact that the corporates do this. They are heavily targeted on winning listings. Whereas when you're a small business owner, you only get paid when you sell a property. So you don't care if you get 100 listings, if you can't sell any of them. If the houses are not on at the right price, not one sales, there's no point in having them. And actually, if you get a listing, it costs you money because you've got to pay to put it on the portals. You've got to take photographs. You've got to do floor plans. You've got to do viewings. So you only want a listing that's going to sell. And yeah.
And you want a 5-star review for your service, because, you know, if you list it, you don't sell it. And then, so you don't, you know, you're only turning 30% into sales. On the back of that, the customer is giving you 1-star review because you've not delivered on the promises that you've made. And this is a lot of business. A lot of businesses are very good at getting the sale, are very bad at delivering on their promises. And therefore, they're, you know, their sort of retention is an issue.
And if you looked at a profit and loss for a big corporate estate agency, you would expect to probably see, firstly, incredibly high costs for their sales team, because their sales team will be a very old school sales team, are sitting doing cold calling, door knocking, things like that. So there's a lot of cost involved in that. And secondly, they're going to have really high marketing costs compared to a more local independent estate agency that, yeah, they're still going to have significant marketing costs, but their
word of mouth,
word of mouth is, and
free marketing
reviews from Trustpilot and Google and things like that, you know, that don't actually cost anything.
Yeah. So that kind of drills into NPS, Net Promoter Score, which is the same sort of thing as reviews and various other things. But one of the other elements you talk about, which is for stock-based business, is stock availability. So this is more about making sure you get that balance of availability so you can make a sale at all times, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is a constant challenge for stock-based businesses, because, you know, I've worked with businesses, for example, that they were paying literally like thousands and thousands of pounds every week to drive traffic to their website. Somebody would land on their website and there was no stock availability. So not only has the business lost a sale, but it's also paid to get that customer on their website in the first place. And unless you've got some way of capturing that customer's information, you know, do they have to put an email address in or anything, then that's a completely lost opportunity. But that has to be balanced with the impact of holding stock and cash flow in your business, because, you know, stock-based businesses, I rattle on about this a lot, but if you are a stock-based business that holds stock, cash flow is a headache. That will never, ever not be the case for stock-based businesses.
Yeah. And let me tell you a story about why stock availability is so important. And this goes back to my newspaper days, because one of the big things that I used to manage was what we'd call availability of newspapers in retailers. So, and this goes for any major driver of footfall into a retailer. So it could be milk. Milk's another good one. It's a bit like a newspaper. It's that low ticket item that drives the footfall into the business that then has a basket spend of, you know, another £10 on top of that newspaper or pint of milk. And the issue with that stock availability is the first day that that customer goes in to pick up their newspaper they used to get in every day and they can't get it that day, they may just brush that off. And the next day they'll go again. But if they go twice in a row and don't have availability, they don't get back to that shop again.
Oh, and Simon, you are a big fan of reading the Sunday Times, and I can't explain how frustrated Simon gets on a Sunday morning if we cannot find that newspaper. Anyway, if we're a little bit late getting out of bed or we don't quite go to the shop before about 10 o'clock, then most of the local shops will be sold out and we have to go to a big supermarket, and that's pretty much the only place that you can guarantee to get it.
Good example, but if you get used to that shop not having that stock, then you stop going to that shop, full stop. Therefore, that shop's lost the lifetime value of that person as a customer. It's that important. So, you know, that's from personal experience, a little bit around the importance of stock availability. It was something I'm directly involved in managing. But again, same difference across any stock-based businesses. If you've done all the hard work of the sales and marketing, of getting somebody to the point of purchase, which is really hard, and then they go to purchase and they can't get it, do you know what? They'll go somewhere else. And if they go somewhere else twice, they probably will never come back.
Yeah. And I mean, it's probably a topic for another podcast, but I used to, part of my role, my last role as finance director in the corporate world, I was also responsible for the pricing department. And one of the things that we used to say is that we need to have a pricing strategy that supports sales and marketing and that drives sales for new and existing customers. And, you know, there's this argument about having loss leading products or very low margin products to attract people into the business. And you see that playing out time and time again in supermarkets, for example, with, you know, the staples like bread and milk and things like that.
Amazing. Well, I think this whole topic, Claire, is an absolutely fascinating one. As we were talking through these, I feel like each of these individual ones could be unpacked further in an individual podcast episode. They're that important to business owners and that detailed, and maybe we'll pick a few of them to deep dive even further into. But I think as an overview, that's barely, it just scratches the surface on metrics for your business, doesn't it? But it is the most important thing across all those elements, especially financially.
Yeah. And I think the reason why I did this is because this is probably, when I'm talking to clients about their sales analysis and how they're tracking their sales, this is probably the one that comes as the biggest shock to most people when I suggest, well, do you have this metric and do you have this metric and what's important to your business? And 9 times out of 10, the business owner says to me, they probably track their leads in some form or another, and then they track their total sales. And as you can see from the conversation we've had today, there are so many
in between,
much more information that you can track that just really helps you understand your business better and make smarter decisions that drive your profit and your cash flow.
I agree. Well, anyway, that's it for this week. Let's move on to this week's Profit Cash Growth Extra.
So this week's Profit Cash Growth Extra, I am going to steal Simon's thunder, because not last week, but the week before, Simon came on very proudly speaking about this little scan feature that you've got on your iPhone notes section.
That was last week.
Was it last week? I thought it was the week before.
Anyway, scan documents into notes.
I bought Simon down a peg or two, as I do enjoy doing every now and again, just to remind him that this functionality exists directly in Google Drive. Now, I'm a big Windows user, but I still link my Google Drive account to my Windows desktop, and it works in exactly the same way through the File Explorer. And Simon is more of a Google man, aren't you?
I fully use Google Work Suite, yes.
Yeah, you don't use Microsoft, really, any of the Microsoft packages, no. Do you? Anyway, if you are wanting to save documents as a PDF, as a picture, for example, then the best way to do this is to scan directly into the Google Drive app.
Okay.
Works really well. I find it the most useful, actually, when I'm out on the road and I've got expense receipts. You know what it's like, you buy a train ticket or you get a taxi or something, and you can just literally turn that receipt into a PDF instantly in your Drive for the bookkeeper to pick up and post some seats.
You are right, and I'm embarrassingly sitting here thinking, you just saved me two more clicks, because what I was doing is scanning it through notes, then going into Google Drive and saving it. Now I can just scan it straight into the folder within Google Drive. It's actually, I think it's running the same technology, because the scanning function is as good as notes. So yeah, I eat humble pie in last week's. I'm glad I took people on a journey there, because some people didn't know you could scan at all with your phone. Now you've gone from notes straight into Google Drive. A top tip.
But to be fair, I mean, this technology, pretty much everything, you can download Adobe on your phone that allows you to do the same thing and save documents to your iPhone. I mean, we're big Apple users, but the technology still exists on Android as well. So
it's across everything. And like I said last week, you know, you can get tons of scanning apps that you pay for and various other things.
So yeah, what I would say is there is no reason for pretty much every business to not be more or less paperless these days.
Yeah.
It's so much easier
to find
technology.
Your stuff, isn't it? And I just find like paper, I lose. Now everything's in a folder. I'm far more organized than I've ever been since the world's gone very digital. Yes, I save way more than I've ever saved, but that's a good thing, because
yeah,
I can find it.
You are a bit of a clutterbug though, aren't you? And it drives
me mad. It doesn't matter digitally,
mad.
Does it? You can search for it. So.
No, it does. I always have an archive folder in all of my drives that I've got, and I dump things in the archive, and if I haven't gone back to them within 6 months, they just get deleted. And we pretty much live our life like that around our household as well, actually, don't we?
You don't need an archive, just delete them. I don't know why you're keeping things any longer than they need to be. I just get rid of them. But it, you know, it's just basic things like insurance documents. You get a car insurance, you know, the new one goes in the drive, the old one just gets deleted because the old one's no good anymore. It's dead easy, isn't it? So anyway, scanning, I don't care how you use it, just make sure you're scanning documents in. But if you do use the Google Worksuite, scan them straight into the Google Drive. Anyway, that's it for this week's podcast. As always, if you did like this, please follow, like, share, subscribe, whatever the different tickly buttons do on all of the different platforms that you do, because it helps us out more than you can ever imagine. And as always, if you're looking for great monthly accounts, great metrics and great analysis, do give a call or go to cashgrowth.com to learn more about what her and her business does. Absolutely fantastic. Watch the YouTube if you want to watch more about 3 monthly sales metrics. Follow on Instagram and Facebook. See you next week. Bye.